because this is probably going to be the best episode of the podcast ever. Welcome to Food Court, everyone. This is a podcast where we love food and we talk about it. I'm Shale McDonald. I'm here with Alan Sutterby.
Hello.
We're two chefs from Edmonton, Alberta, Canada.
Let's get to it. We had a couple of ideas of what to talk about. Do you want to do mine?
Yeah, sure. How it normally works is we both bring a topic. And Alan's topic this week is something along the lines of how to escape getting into ruts when you're writing menus and how to find something original. Is that right?
Yeah. Well, okay. So I hope I'm not throwing you for a loop here. I changed the phrasing of it to try and make it a little bit more of an open discussion. But
please, yeah, let's hear your phrasing.
The background here is that I'm taking over a culinary class at NAIT, at the Northern Alberta Institute of Technology. It's an evening dining class, so it's one in which students are actually operating more or less a fine dining restaurant 4 nights a week. And I have some creative control over the menu. I could just swoop in and run the menu that they have now, but I thought it would be a good opportunity to, especially in a fine dining kind of environment, and with it, like it being a culinary instruction environment, to try and make the point that you should probably try and do something that's creative or original in some way, just something that kind of adds to the dialogue around food in your community and not just rip off something else that you've seen that you think might be cool or tasty. So anyways, my kind of broad discussion point here was, as a chef, Shale, do you feel that you are obligated to be creative? Or another way of putting it might be, like, to be a great chef, do you have to be creative?
I definitely don't think that that's necessarily true of every chef position.
Yes.
But I do think that if you aren't creative or don't strive to be creative or don't want to be creative or don't feel like creativity is, you know, something that you're gifted with, which is sort of like, you know, another tangent that we could go off on in terms of, like whether or not I think that it's possible for people to not be creative. I kind of think that, like, there are some people who don't really feel like that they're creative thinkers, but that it's just that they haven't really, I don't know, maybe had a revelation about their own creativity, or, you know, like, or seen their own creativity as like a quality that they can foster, mm-hmm. and have some input into and control over and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think that I think that for, you know, a dining experience where, and whether that's like fine dining or pub dining or a picnic, if there's not something like that, that sort of like creativity kind of provides a little bit of experience or like a little bit of wow factor, mm-hmm. you know, like having, yeah. something that you haven't been exposed to before, can make something memorable. And I don't think that people are usually like really happy with dining experiences where they don't get something interesting or something that's memorable or something that,
right.
you know, makes them feel like they're getting something more than what they expected, or something like that. So I think it's really important in most dining situations. I don't really, I guess it sort of plays into something like fast food in a way, I guess, like,
how so?
Well, most of the creativity in fast food is on the marketing side, mm-hmm. right? Like, you know, so whether that has anything to do with being a creative chef or not, I don't really know. I don't really have much exposure to that, but
right. I think so when I say, yeah, when I say creative, I'm thinking of like there's all kinds of relatively mundane everyday kind of problem solving that happens when you work in a kitchen, and mm-hmm. surely you need to be creative to figure a lot of that out. But I think that when most people who don't work in the industry think of what a chef, if you've just watched like say Chef's Table or something on Netflix, and when someone says chef, you think of René Redzepi or Magnus Nilsson or whatever, their idea of creativity is more like this kind of artistic epiphany kind of that happens when you invent a new dish kind of thing.
Right. The composition of a dish is like the thing that most people probably think of when they think about creativity and
yeah,
food, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Or new techniques or kind of like modernist cuisine type stuff. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of when I say it's kind of like people, not me, but a lot of people will say that like chefs need to be artistic, or that, you know, some chefs are able to elevate cooking to an art. Which I don't know, maybe that's true, but I think generally I don't think of cooking as an art at all. Like I think of it as a craft or a trade. And you need to be creative, but it's usually within the framework of technique and the constraints of your kitchen. And you don't often get the chance to kind of do the high flying acrobatic creativity that you see on TV. I guess, but
yeah. And I think like that's a pretty, like your view of it, I think is like a pretty well contended view. Like it's, you know, sort of the Anthony Bourdain philosophy or
okay,
something,
yeah.
You know, mm-hmm. that cooking is a craft and, you know, like there's some like creativity in it, but mainly it's about honing your skills and mm-hmm. being proficient and being excellent at your job or whatever.
And so like, yeah, that kind of, for me then, if the question is, do you have an obligation to be creative, to be a good chef? To me, the answer is no, you don't. Mm-hmm. You have an obligation to make delicious food. And that means you need maybe you need to be a slave to technique and things like that. But like, you don't need to reinvent the wheel every time you plate a salad. Like you, mm-hmm. and of course, like you said earlier, like it totally depends on the environment, and making a salad in a diner or a cafeteria is different, and people have different expectations than if they're paying an arm and a leg for their meal. And they've been, you know, had to wait months to get a reservation and stuff. And so, yeah, it certainly behooves you to go above and beyond and try and provide that twist or that interest or whatever it is, that surprise. And you're right, it mm-hmm. definitely makes the dining experience more memorable. But yeah, for me, I would much rather have a properly executed or an unoriginal but properly executed dish than something wild and crazy. Like I was thinking about this with creme brulee, because no one, very, very few chefs have the, I don't know what the word is, the courage to just put creme brulee, as in like vanilla flavored custard, on the menu. They have to like put cinnamon and orange zest, or they have to put candy canes yeah. in it, or whatever it is, right? But to me, it's like, if the custard is set properly and the brulee is nice, like I would way rather just have that flavored with vanilla than something that's less than perfect, but has as a kooky flavor in it. But
yeah, I think that is sort of like a problematic side of kind of fine dining culture specifically, mm-hmm. is that, you know, a lot of cooks who come up in that kind of environment value the like creative idea of like dish composition over technique in a lot of cases, right. not everyone, and definitely not everyone I know even, but like I think that there is a tendency to sort of see the creativity part of it, or like the dish composition or menu writing part of it, as the creative end goal that you're striving to get to,
right?
And in a lot of cases I sort of feel like technique kind of gets left by the wayside. And I totally agree with you. It's really hard to find a really well, beautifully executed creme brulee. And I've had shockingly few of them compared to how many are on menus out there.
Right.
But I do love that dessert, you know, and I fell in love with it, having an example of it in a restaurant in Montreal, like a decade and a half ago, which the name of, I cannot remember. But it was, yeah, it was just like a vanilla creme brulee and it was so perfectly executed. And I'd never had anything like that before. And I had had creme brulee before and I was like, oh, like,
yeah,
this can be really amazing. You know, once you understand that that exists and that the technique for it is what is required to make it amazing and not necessarily like flavoring it with passion fruit and garnishing it with, I don't know,
flowers.
Yeah. Or like, dehydrated honeycombs or something. Right. I don't know, but
so,
but yeah, like I do think that, you know, those are sort of like two sides of a coin that when they come together, like when the two of them come together, you can have like a really transcendent experience. Like, you know, I do think that there probably is a version of creme brulee out there that has a flavoring in it that I wouldn't have thought of, and which is also executed perfectly and makes it something completely or altogether different.
But. Mm-hmm. Yeah, of course. And actually that reminds me of, what was that? There was a show that you put me on to.
What is that called?
The 7 Days Out. Is that what it's called?
Yeah, 7 Days Out, I think, yeah.
So it's like a documentary series that shows the 7 days prior to some manner of big event, right? And the one that you had me watch was for the reopening of 11 Madison Park.
Yeah. That's a crazy episode of television.
Yeah. And you can stop me if we've already talked about this in a previous recording, but the chef Daniel Hume was talking about how for anything to be on the menu there needs to meet 4 requirements. 2 of them are pretty obvious. It needs to taste great and it needs to be beautiful. Like the plating needs to be beautiful. Mm-hmm. But the other ones were that it needs to have, I don't remember the language he used, but something original about it. And it needs to add something to the conversation about food.
Yeah.
So that like, that's a, something that he's set out for that kitchen.
And so what does that mean, Alan? I understand what something delicious means, and I understand, what was the second one?
It needs to look good.
Oh yeah, and I understand what that means.
Yeah.
And I understand to some extent what it means for the dish to have something original about it.
Yeah.
But what does that mean for it to add to the conversation about food? That seems pretty esoteric to me. And it seems like you could interpret that in a lot of different ways. And I'm not like trying to feign ignorance about it. Or like, I guess I understand sort of what he's trying to get at, but like, how do you frame that in a way that it's possible to like, you know, come up with an idea that, you know, contributes to that conversation.
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, it's interesting. Like he doesn't just say it needs to be completely new and never done before. He says it needs to add to the conversation about food, I think. Yeah. Something like that. So that's interesting to me because it's like he doesn't want novelty for novelty's sake, I would say.
Right.
Like they're doing something new either because it's a technique that might be useful to in the development of new dishes, or that it's saying something about the way that we eat and who we are, I guess. That's super esoteric.
Yeah, that one's super esoteric.
But actually that part, like what it says about who we are and all that is actually addressed by his 4th requirement for a dish is that it needs to have intentionality. In other words, like,
all right.
Why is it that 11 Madison Park in New York is making this dish right now? Like, why are we making it and not, you know, someone in Europe or whatever? Like, it has to say something about New York and about the people there.
Right. Well, that to me seems to have more of a conversational sort of component to it than,
right,
you know, like the creative part.
Mm-hmm.
Because like 11 Madison Park exists in this, like it exists in a location, which is in New York City.
Mm-hmm.
And then it also exists in a non-localized sort of like set of high-end fine dining restaurants. Yeah,
the rarefied world of that caliber of fine dining. Yep.
Yeah, which that like world of fine dining has a lot of, whether it's in America or Canada or Europe or Asia, there's a lot of overlap in terms of the people that work in those restaurants. Like, it's kind of a small world. Like, a lot of the people know each other. A lot of the chefs, you know, work in a restaurant in one country and then go and start another restaurant in another country. And all of those sort of like techniques and ideas and like progressive sort of food creativity gets like cross-pollinated across all of those different restaurants. So like 11 Madison Park, for instance, is like in conversation with restaurants in New York, but then it's also in conversation with high-end fine dining restaurants in Europe, for instance, because probably most of the cooks that they hire have experience in those restaurants or whatever. So,
right. Yeah.
And so I guess like, what conversation are we talking about? Are we talking about the conversation of like sustainability of food in New York State or sustainability of food in the US? Are we talking about the conversation of the pushing the boundaries of creativity in food, like in Western culture? Are we talking about like the conversation of food as it exists as sort of like a cultural, an engine for like cultural fusion? You know, there's a lot of different conversations you can kind of be having there. And I think it's like, how do you pick and choose which conversation your dish is a part of?
Right. And I don't think that there was a particular vein, like a specific one, like you mentioned a few. I think that it really is just the kind of culture that the really cutting edge restaurants like 11 Madison Park or Noma set out for themselves, right? That they are not going to make the same dishes day in and day out, and they're always going to be moving forward like that. So I think it's more of a, I'm sure the exact kind of conversation or the bit that it's adding to the conversation changes dish by dish and day by day. But I think it's more just like it's a standard that he's setting that is supposed to, yeah, lay the foundation for the kitchen culture there, for the people who are doing the development.
I have a few kind of ways that I try to keep the food that I'm making interesting for myself. And like one of those things is, I think, or like one of my criteria for how to sort of know whether a dish is going to be interesting for me or not. And this is also like a weird, vague thing to say, but it's that like a dish has to have a story.
Yeah. Yeah.
About it. And like, I guess that's maybe sort of along the same lines. Like, it doesn't really matter necessarily what that story is, but that there's something about the dish, whether it's like a cultural aspect of it or a sustainability aspect of it or a flavor aspect of it or something, that lends some kind of authenticity to it or something.
That's hugely important. It actually reminds me, we were talking about when we were talking about like secrecy and like secret guarding,
right?
And how like you could have every recipe from, I think I said the French Laundry or whatever, like you could have every recipe Thomas Keller ever wrote. It doesn't mean that like opening that you can suddenly open a restaurant of that caliber overnight. And likewise, like it wouldn't, even if you could, that restaurant wouldn't make sense in Edmonton, for instance, like, and it wouldn't even necessarily be successful in Edmonton, because it would not have any kind of authenticity to it at all. Do you know what I mean? Like it would be seen for what it was. It would be like as a ripoff kind of, but yeah, it's important. That sense of place is like really what distinguishes, well, in any good restaurant, but especially in the top Sam Pell top 50 in the world list and stuff. Like you look at places like Osteria Francescana and like what it says about food in Modena and Emilia Romagna and what obviously Noma says about food in Copenhagen. Like you can't even create most of that food outside of those regions, for want of ingredients and things like that.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
But that's like, really what that's what the trend has been in high-end dining is like intensely focused on time and place and people and culture, and like the food that's being made in those kitchens can only be made there, really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which is what makes it special.
Yeah. And I think like how that applies to Canadian cuisine is like a topic of conversation for another time. Yes. For sure. But like, that's an interesting thing that I rack my brain about, like on a fairly consistent basis.
Yeah. Obviously, we'll have to talk about it at some point. I will say really quickly, I find it so annoying when people ask me if there's a Canadian cuisine, but we'll talk about it later. I don't know if this is dragging on too long, but if we want to get to menu ruts.
Okay, yeah.
I do want, in terms of creativity, I want to just start off by saying, like, I've been in at least two, I've had at least two jobs, kitchen jobs, where I got to a point where I was like, there's nothing left to do. There's nothing left. There's nothing new left to do here. Mm-hmm. Like for instance, at Elm Cafe where we made, it was like simple soup, salad, sandwich, and the relentless, demand for new sandwiches. Cause there was a time where we were doing three new sandwiches every day.
Mm-hmm.
It just got to a point, and then other shops were opening that were kind of doing the same thing. And it got to a point where I felt like we had done everything. Obviously there's always something new, but it really felt like we had done everything, or like as soon as, or that if we didn't do it this week, then the other shops would do it next week.
Right.
And it was just like so frustrating. I don't know. Do you have any tips and tricks for kind of forced creativity? Compulsory creativity?
I mean, yes, I sort of do. And I probably should have thought harder about them and how to present them before we started down the road of talking about this topic. But I guess I sort of have a process.
Mm-hmm.
So step one of my process is finding a way to give myself time to brainstorm.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone needs their own way to sort of like start that process or give themselves the space to do like a little bit of brainstorming. But for me, and especially like when I've been in a situation where I have a busy kitchen job that takes a lot of hours, sometimes the only time that I can find to sort of like shut everything out and just sort of like let my mind wander or daydream or whatever is in the shower.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of my food ideas or menu ideas come when I force myself to stop listening to podcasts or music and stand in the shower.
You force yourself to have a shower.
I shower every day, but I usually listen to podcasts and sometimes I listen to music.
Yeah.
And but if I know that I need to do some creative work, I don't do any of that. And I just like stand in the shower and just have a good think.
Yes.
About what it is that I'm trying to do.
Mm.
And I find that usually, you know, like if I'm sitting at a desk looking at a blank screen, trying to come up with a menu, or surfing the web looking for food ideas or something like that,
mm-hmm.
it can be daunting, and I can feel sometimes like I can get writer's block.
Yeah.
But I do find that if I give myself time to let my mind wander, I usually get inspired by something.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I usually start thinking about something that I like, or reminiscing about something that, you know, that I miss or something like that. And then that can kind of be a jumping off point for having a little daydream about something.
Mm-hmm.
And then as long as you're open to whatever comes up in that situation, when you give yourself time to sort of like daydream, you can sort of like pick something out of that. And even if it's not something that specifically relates to food or a dish that would be suitable for the menu that you're trying to come up with food for or something like that, you can usually use it as a jumping off point.
Mm-hmm.
And then, so I'll take that, you know, like I'll take that little shower meditation and like try to write down anything that I sort of feel like was inspiring about it, and mm-hmm. then use that as like a jumping off point. From there, once you have like a little seed of creativity, there's always like, especially in like food work and restaurant work, there's always constraints, right? So then I look at my little seed of inspiration and I look at the set of constraints that I have to meet.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's usually like a fairly visible line to be drawn between like what my source of inspiration is and what food needs to go on the menu.
Yeah.
If it's a diner menu, you know, and my seed of creativity is, I don't know, a piece of pie that I had at a friend's birthday party when I was 8 or something like that.
Right.
Then I can look at that and be like, oh, you know, there, well, we should have pie as a dessert on this menu. Or is there like something that I can do with the textures of a pie that would fit in a diner menu that's not necessarily dessert or something like that. Mm. And then, you know, and then use that as a, you know, and then once you kind of like get that part of the idea, you know, then it's just about like sort of refining it and polishing it and making it fit within the context of the menu and making it fit within the context of the dining experience that you're mm-hmm. trying to provide or whatever.
And that actually touches on another important thing. Again, the kind of the difference between chef work as portrayed on TV and what it's really like is that menus are not written in a vacuum. They're not like, they're never, ever like a wholly creative. What am I trying to say? Like there's always, you are always thinking about the people that you're cooking for or who's writing your paycheck or who's, yeah, the constraints of your kitchen. So writing a good menu is not like a purely creative or like artistic act. You take these little seeds of inspiration, these little kernels, and then like do 100 little problem solving, like work out 100 different problems to figure out what's the best actual dish and how it comes together for your application, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And the other thing that's sort of great about it, if you're in a position where you have the freedom to try a bunch of things, is that not everything's going to work.
Mm-hmm.
Not everything's going to work as well as you want it to. Some things might come out the way that you like expect them to, and you're really happy with them, but they aren't very well received.
Mm.
Or, you know, like there's a lot of sort of like bumps in the road there. And so it like doesn't pay to be extremely self-critical. You want to be making good food for your customers, obviously, but you also have to, you know, like accept that not every dish that you make is going to change the world or whatever. Right. And so, you know, you have to give yourself the freedom to sort of like say, you know, this is something that I want to try and hopefully we can make it amazing, and maybe we can't and we have to change it. And if we have to change it, how do we change it to make it amazing? And if you give yourself sort of that room to iterate
mm-hmm.
and, you know, to like work out your ideas, I think that that's necessary in order to make good food.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and I think how they kind of approach that in fine dining restaurants where people are planning a trip around going to eat at a very expensive restaurant or something like that, where you want every customer to be extremely satisfied with their experience.
Yeah.
Is they just, you know, like they have no choice but to give themselves the time to do that iteration up front before any dish ever makes it to the customer.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, whereas if you're not operating a destination restaurant, you can give yourself, there are ways to give yourself a little bit of room to play, like by having featured dishes or things like that and trying things out. And then if things really work out, then they can, you know, get promoted to your regular yeah. menu or whatever. And I think like every restaurant I've ever really worked in, that's sort of how it works. Like there's an outlet to try things out and to give it, and that works well for customers too. Like, for returning customers, it gives them a chance to try something new that they haven't tried before.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously you're trying to make every feature, be just as good as a dish that would be on the regular menu. But then, you know, some of them work out really well and you're like, man, this is amazing. We should keep it on, and people really love it. And then mean, that's kind of how it's been working in the ice cream shop too.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like we just have some of our like rotating flavors are just runaway successes. And some of our flavors that we have on the menu all the time don't necessarily sell as well.
Right.
And so from time to time, we'll like swap in something that was just supposed to be like a feature rotating flavor and just put it on the always menu because people can't get enough of it.
Has the always menu, has anything been knocked off the always menu since you've been there that has surprised you?
Yeah. Yeah. A few things like, I think we've had like three additions to the always menu since we opened. Mm-hmm. One of them for sure is, when we first opened, one of the always flavors was, coconut charcoal vegan ice cream.
Okay.
It was, I thought, really good, but didn't sell super well. Mm-hmm. And was also, this is a little like behind the curtain peek, but it was also like kind of difficult to scoop.
Okay.
The consistency of it made it so that if it wasn't stored at the right temperature, it was like, it got like quite a bit harder than a lot of the ice creams that we keep in the dipping cabinet. Mm-hmm. And okay. So it was like not a favorite amongst the front of house staff who have to scoop the ice cream. And we ran a vegan chocolate peanut butter rotating flavor mm-hmm. 1 month, and it was really well received and people really loved it. And so we just wound up swapping it out.
Mm-hmm.
Another one is when we opened, we were supposed to have a peanut butter and brownie batter mm-hmm. ice cream.
Yeah.
So it was like peanut butter base with a brownie batter swirl in it. And it was like one of the sort of like faves amongst myself and the owners when we were like doing the original menu testing mm-hmm. and we were all really excited about it. But then when it came to produce it, when you're producing small batch of it in the countertop machine, it works fine. But when you go to produce it in like the batch freezer that we have, mm-hmm. for some reason, because I think the fat in the peanut butter freezes at a different temperature than the fat in the dairy, it just never worked properly. It always came out like in this like really kind of split, not very appealing kind mm-hmm. of not smooth.
Yeah.
And just looked like, you know, looked like a split sauce kind of
mm-hmm.
wasn't emulsified properly. And it took us like a really long time to figure out what the problem was, like to A, diagnose the problem and B, come up with a fix for it. Mm-hmm. That it never really made it on the always menu until 6 months after we opened. And then even after that, it was a delicious flavor. I thought it was great. A lot of people really liked it. It just didn't sell super well. Mm-hmm. And like we usually didn't have any problem producing it. But from time to time, like if you let it freeze too hard too fast, you would run into the same problem.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, there were a few times throughout the year when we had batches of it that we had to fix, which is a long process of like melting it and then reblending it 2 liters by 2 liters in a Vitamix.
Okay.
And then re-churning it. And we also like, and then during the year, one of our back of house staff members, Jess, came up with an idea for like a Rocky Road takeoff flavor
yep.
called River Valley Road.
Yep. I've had it.
And that flavor turned out to be super popular, and it kind of provides some of the same appeal as the peanut butter and brownie swirl ice cream
we were doing. Yep.
And so we just like decided that, you know, we wanted to have River Valley Road on the menu, and we decided that, you know, the peanut butter brownie one was sort of the one that was selling the least, that was the biggest pain in the butt. And so mm-hmm. see you later.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I mean, you know, you have to be kind of open to that sort of iteration, open to the idea that your favorite dish might be a stinker.
Yeah.
or whatever.
But I find like, and maybe we should be wrapping this topic up soon, but like, I find that when a restaurant has operated for a while and you start to figure out what works and what doesn't, like you end up with like, it kind of kills creativity a lot of the time. So it's like, there's, mm-hmm. oh yeah, we've got to have, like there's stuff that you just can't take off the menu anymore.
Yeah.
And so like,
and then also when you were talking about the Elm menu, like there's a, part of the sort of thing with, you know, feeling like you've sort of like tried all the ideas. I feel like when I'm in that position, it feels like that's kind of being imposed by the set of constraints. Like as you're operating a restaurant and you understand what works in the space and like what kind of food you can produce, the list of constraints tends to grow.
Yeah.
And not lessen. Once you understand which things fail and which things succeed, you're always trying to sort of detect a reason for the failure of the things that don't do well.
Mm-hmm.
And then those reasons become part of the constraints list. Like we can't do this type of thing because it doesn't do well because we can't reheat it properly or we can't store it properly,
mm-hmm.
or something like that. And like, as you're operating, that list of constraints tends to grow. And so the list of things that you can realistically try to accomplish and do a good job at kind of gets smaller. And so you either have to find a way to change the list of constraints by adding, I don't know, different equipment or different ways of storing the food or different techniques or something like that, to like change the list of constraints, or you have to find a different way to break through into a different level of creativity within those constraints.
I think, like, don't you think that sometimes that the list of perceived constraints is like not actually truth and just like something in the cook's or in the owner's minds, like it didn't work last time and so it will never work again kind of thing? Like,
definitely.
I think that, like, the other, besides Elm, the other kitchen I was thinking about that I worked in that really it became difficult to be creative in at some point for me was at Jack's Grill. And it seemed like the restaurant had operated for so long, and it got to a point where it's like, on the entree menu, it's like, well, we have to have the beef tenderloin and we have to have a duck breast and we have to have rack of lamb and it can't even be Alberta lamb. It's got to be New Zealand lamb. Like, and there was just, it just, in hindsight, I wonder if it was just the like catering to a small part of the, like in a small but influential part of the clientele. But then unfortunately, like the dining scene in Edmonton changed and we were left with all of these constraints that just were completely incompatible with how people wanted to eat out. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm actually like fairly guilty of that. I have to like take time or request the help of other people to sort of like snap me out of that type of mindset sometimes,
right?
Like in terms of,
and get fresh eyes, you know, on it kind of. Yeah.
Yeah.
Do we resolve anything here?
Okay. So what are we talking about? Is food is creativity obligatory? Was that the,
yeah.
Yeah. No, it's not, but
do it anyways.
I think, but it's perceived by a lot of people to be an important part of cooking. And I think that, you know, for a lot of people, it's a really exciting and positive part of what a career in cooking has to offer.
Yes.
And so, you know, like I find in most cases, it's not maybe obligatory, but it's expected.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that without it, you don't really have a food industry, you know, like not with independent restaurants or anything like that. Like, you know, you would just have chains or fast food franchises where there's one person injecting the creativity or a few people injecting the creativity at a very high level. And then everything else is just technique or whatever, and everything gets passed down the line. And so we said we were going to circle back to ruts. I guess we kind of started to talk about that, hey? Like, how do I get out of a rut? I stand in the shower and wait till it hits me in the face. But I think that, like, did you... So you've been working on this project to come up with a new menu for your new appointment at work.
Mm-hmm.
And how has that been going? Is that mostly working out? Are you having a hard time with it?
I still need to pitch it to the, I still need to get it stamped and approved. At the start, it was quite difficult because it didn't have like a clear theme or direction it needed to go. It was so open-ended, I guess is what I mean,
mm-hmm.
that I didn't quite know where to begin. But I find for my creative process, I'll find like, I need to find a kind of foundation or like a touch point kind of. And once I find that, the creativity comes a lot more easy. So for this menu, I really focused on that idea of place. So I, as much as possible, and again, nothing happens in a vacuum, and there are certain like learning outcomes I needed to ensure for the students, but I wanted each dish to say something about Edmonton or Alberta. And I actually took a lot of inspiration from, so actually in terms of the process of like trying to just like produce creative ideas, I'll often just go to a book like a cookbook that inspires me, not because mm-hmm. like the dishes or the ingredients that they're using have anything to do with what I'm doing, but the one that I turned to recently was the Momofuku cookbook by David Chang, and the kind of like it took me a long time to come around to it because I was kind of against like fusion cuisine for a long time. But the way he's able to kind of smash together these like really gutsy American like products, like whatever, like bacon and stuff like that, into you know, cuisines of Japan and Korea and China, is really, I appreciate more and more as years go on. And so I mm-hmm. kind of took that as this jumping off point for a lot of the like quasi-naturalized ethnic foods that are important to Edmonton, like Ukrainian and right. Chinese and things like that. And then after I hit on that, like focusing on an ingredient that's important to Alberta or a preparation that's important to Alberta, like whatever, like pierogies or green onion cakes or something like that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it came much more easy.
And does that mean there are going to be green onion cakes on your menu? Well,
this is a whole other can of worms.
That can be a topic of conversation. But
I will say, so, and maybe this is how we'll end it, but like going back to 11 Madison Park, this is a major trend in fine dining is recognizing those like kind of like blue collar, authentic dishes of the neighborhood. And reimagining them in a fine dining setting. So like, I don't know, mm-hmm. I don't remember what year this was from, but I was reading an 11 Madison Park menu. It had black and white cookies on it. It had beer and pretzels on it. It had cheesecake on it. Like not, huh. So like iconic New York
yeah.
dish or like preparations or dishes, but obviously like completely reimagined so that they can charge, several hundred dollars for a meal, but
and hopefully also so that they can provide customers with an experience they'll never forget.
But there's kind of like a tongue in cheek, like it's cheeky, right? Like
yeah,
you're sitting in just like such a lavish dining room, but you're eating beer and pretzels. One of the desserts was like an apple fritter, basically like an apple donut.
Right.
But anyways, and so I'm hoping like I have these kind of these similar cheeky references to really cheap and comforting food that is common here, like pierogies and cabbage rolls and green onion cakes and mm-hmm. stuff like that. So we'll see. Maybe it might not be approved. I don't know. We'll see.
I guess we'll find out. Yeah, yeah. I'm super curious to hear about it at some point. Okay, well, I also brought a topic to talk about today, Alan. Let's see if there's still room for it or not.
Okay.
It's actually like kind of a pet topic that I've had for a while, and I sort of feel like it only applies to you. Somehow, last week when we talked about bringing this topic into the show, you convinced me that it was also going to be applicable to myself. So
okay.
I don't exactly remember what you said to make me think that. And now when I'm looking at the topic, I'm like, I don't know if I have anything to say about this, but I think it'll be interesting to have your perspective on it anyways. And then maybe through the course of our tangential conversation, you can remind me of what it is that I have to contribute.
Okay. Sure.
So my topic is kind of a question for you, Alan. You're a father of two children. What is it like as a chef cooking for your kids?
Well, to put it concisely, it can be really fun. It can be really frustrating. I have a daughter who just turned 5 and a son who is 14 months old. So he's only even been eating for 8 months.
Right.
We do, there's this kind of, progressive hippie practice called baby led weaning, which is
okay,
which means that we don't buy baby food, we don't make purees and spoon feed our kids. We basically like just put like right from the get-go, right from 6 months, like we started putting small bits of food on a tray in front of them and they pick it up and figure out how to get it in their mouths and make a real mess doing it.
Right.
I should know. I don't know all the benefits, the supposed benefits of that, but it helps with motor skills and stuff like that. So the funny thing is that for my daughter, so for our older child, basically from the time she started eating solid food until she was maybe 3 years old, she was shockingly open and accepting of almost anything you would put in front of her. She would eat sour cherries like dozens at a time. She ate octopus. She ate like spicy food, like chorizo.
Oh, really?
Yeah. She would just like, we could more or less make what we would normally make for ourselves and maybe put a little less salt in it, if any, and cut it in smaller pieces and put in front of her. And she would eat it. So that was really exciting. But then,
yeah, that sounds very exciting, and it sounds rare to me. It's not what I normally hear from parents about the experience of feeding their kids.
So the tide turned sometime around the age of 3. She became quite a bit more picky, but there was still a lot of really great, like the most gratifying times are when you make something. Make something that I like, and maybe I don't expect a child to like, but she just like goes bananas for her. Like,
right.
Like for a long time, her favorite food was split pea soup. And I would like,
oh, really?
we would smoke ham hocks and then make a broth and like cook yellow split peas in it. And the first time she ate it, she was stunned. She said, we wrote these words down because they were so funny coming out of a child's mouth. She said, this soup is everything. This soup is so good, I can't even laugh. Those are the words that she said. And for a long time, split pea soup was her favorite food. And I was so proud because I love it. It's one of my favorite soups for sure. But it's also like not sexy and not something, it's not like you usually think that a child's favorite food would be grilled cheese or whatever, but yeah, split pea soup.
Right.
But there's a bit of a tragic turn to this story. One time she was quite sick. Like she had an upset stomach, and to make her feel better, I made her split pea soup because I thought it would help.
Her favorite thing, right?
But yeah, because she was nauseated, and then she like was like presented with this bowl of like smoked pork soup, it like switched a, it switched something in her brain. And now when she smells it, she thinks of when she was sick. Oh, and so she doesn't eat sweet pea soup anymore, which is a total bummer. But
yeah,
she still has pretty good taste though. She, one of her favorite meals is schnitzel actually, which I think is really cool.
Yeah, that's cool.
And the usual suspects like pizza and wraps and stuff like that.
Does that get boring? Like, I'm assuming you do a lot of the food preparation. Is that?
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
Do you get like, do you have like a way to like, you know, like if you have to make a, you know, if you have to make 7 wraps in a week, like, do you have a way of sort of like making it fun for yourself? Or
we've got a pretty good like repertoire of dishes that we know the kids will eat. And it's still like, they're still interesting and delicious enough for the parents as well. Mm-hmm. One thing, if I'm uncertain of how it will be received, especially by Cora, by the older one, is I get her to either help with the preparation, although she's not, it doesn't work very well for her right now. Like, she can't do a whole lot in the kitchen, but give her some kind of buy-in where, like, instead of me making, okay, here's a good example. Like, Lisa and I really like making panzanella. We'll like oven roast tomatoes and make croutons and add cucumbers and olives or whatever. Like, not something that you would usually think of feeding a small child, but instead of just making panzanella and putting it in front of Cora, we have make your own salad nights, and I'll put all of the components out on the table and she'll build her own salad. And then we'll put the secret dressing on it, which is just balsamic vinegar. And she'll eat bowls and bowls of it. And it's like, this is a pretty loose take on panzanella, but it's like croutons and cucumbers and quinoa and roasted tomatoes and sauteed onions and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So that's a nice little, that's a little trick. If most meals we can convert to build your own ...
Right.
And then she'll participate. And
yeah, that is a good trick.
Yeah.
Do you have like a little step stool that she can stand on and like work with you at the counter?
Yeah. And she'll, she knows her quarter, half and full teaspoons, so she can like measure baking powder and salt for baking recipes.
Oh, cool.
She'll stir stuff. We got her a set of, knives for Christmas. it's like, they're like plastic serrated knives, but,
cool.
They're shaped like one of them is shaped like a santoku and one of them is shaped like a chef's knife. And so
really?
We've started, like, she knows how to hold the knife, like with the, like, you know what I mean? Not like just holding the handle, but with her index finger over the ridge and stuff.
Yeah.
And yeah, she's been cutting vegetables this week, and
that's fun.
I think that's one part of our family life that will hopefully flourish in, like, as she gets older. I'm not naive enough to think that like she'll be as in love with food as Lisa and I are. Like, I don't think she'll necessarily be like completely engrossed in it, but I hope that she's able to help and enjoy time in the kitchen more as she grows up.
Yeah. Well, I think just like having that type of sort of like broad exposure to it, I think can't hurt anyway.
Yeah.
You know,
and
she, you know, like, she might rebel and never want to touch a knife ever again in her life, or
that's,
you know, but.
And actually, speaking of that, one of the things that I'm preparing myself for is that, like, in terms of rebellion, is the possibility of her wanting to be vegetarian or vegan.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Which is,
that's almost certain to happen.
Yeah, I think, like, so.
Yeah.
Which is fine. But we're definitely like, we eat a lot of meat, but it's not like we don't have steak every night, but we like we cook with lard and stock and ground meat mm-hmm. and braised meat and stuff like that a lot. Like it's an important part of our larder and freezers and stuff.
Yeah.
So yeah, I can see that on the horizon, and I'm just trying to be open. And we do a lot of meat cutting at home, like whole chickens and sides of pork and the rest. And Cora
yeah.
sees it and says, that's gross. And I just try and be open about it and say, yes, this is what the meat that we eat is. And I don't know if that's, I don't know how else to deal with it, but I'm
yeah.
half expecting some kind of rebellion like that, which I'll be open, which I'll be accommodating to, but.
Yeah, totally. But I mean, you're not probably going to want to eat vegan food all the time to accommodate that. So it's probably going to be a situation where you wind up having to like bifurcate your food preparation
right.
to provide a vegetarian meal and a non-vegetarian meal or something like that. But
yeah, I don't know how successful this will be. Like talking to a child, but I'd like to drive home the point that your diet doesn't need to be an ideology. Like it doesn't mm-hmm. like if you aren't keen on the meat that we're cooking at home, then yeah, you should eat less meat and let's figure out ways to eat less meat. Mm-hmm. But I don't think you need to be like a proselytizing ideologue about it and say, I'm never going to eat meat ever. Because it just deprives you of so much of, well, I don't know, your culture yeah. and stuff like that. But,
I think your best bet is to steer clear of that topic of conversation, honestly, because I feel like, I don't know, like, I feel like, you know, the impetus for most people and most young people when they're trying to form their own identity and when they come into contact like with things that sort of cross those boundaries, you know, like, you know, in terms of like diet, like practical things and then ideological things, mm-hmm. how it affects our environment or
right.
how it, you know, cause harm to animals or things like that. Yeah. It's just like, it's going to be like a real uphill battle trying to, you know, convince someone that they, you know, shouldn't have an ideology about it. Like, I think the most important thing that you can probably do is like, allow her to keep her broadly exposed to a bunch of different things and, you know, allow her an outlet to make whatever choice that she wants,
yeah.
you know, like
yeah.
without feeling like she has to, you know, I feel like a lot of the radicalization of veganism comes from, you know, like people in situations where they do want to change their diet, but someone else is pressuring them not to.
Right.
And so they yeah. kind of latch on to the ideological aspect of it as like a tool to, you know, to like enforce their right to choose that, mm-hmm. you know, aspect for themselves or whatever. And the ideology of it like gives them a real like good verbal way to
entrench, you know, like, themselves and yeah.
to push back yeah. on, you know. And so I think your best bet is just to keep eating what you want to eat and help her figure out what she wants to
yeah.
eat. And yeah, but
I think I am only half remembering this now, but we have mutual friends who operate a food truck mm-hmm. and have a daughter. And if I remember right, their daughter decided she's
are you talking about Drift Food Truck?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
So Nevin and Kara Fensky and their daughter Avon, I believe I was told that Avon decided that she didn't want to eat meat. She would be, I think 7 years old. If I remember, they as a family started eating vegetarian or vegan. And it lasted for a few weeks. And I think it was quite difficult. It was quite hard on Nevin and Kara. But that eventually,
yeah, I can imagine.
Avon just one day said, I think I'll have chicken today.
Yeah.
And maybe she does eat less meat now or doesn't want to eat it every day, but mm-hmm. she is not, it's not a no holds barred kind of like she's
well, and I think that's totally expected too, you know, like it takes time for her to figure out what she really does want. Like maybe she, you know, like one person's point of view can convince you of one thing and then somebody else's point of view can maybe convince you that that other person's point of view right. isn't the end all be all.
Yeah.
And like one day you might decide that you find meat disgusting. And then like a year later you might decide, oh, well, actually I kind of crave it or whatever, you know? And I mean, I'm not saying that I don't think anyone should stick to their convictions or whatever, but you know, like I do think that it's important, and especially for kids, like, I mean, to like give them the ability to make those choices or whatever.
Yeah. The one interesting tangent, it's a tangent, but it's kind of related to our topic that I think you could weigh in on. It's really hilarious to me how different the food that I ate growing up is to the food that Cora eats. And it's partly the difference of 30 years, but it's a lot of it has to do with like the, well, kind of like the baby led weaning stuff. Like Lisa and I are kind of tapped into this kind of hippie progressive ideas that I don't know if they existed 30 years ago or if my parents just didn't know about them because the internet didn't exist. I don't know, but things like,
I think it's probably the latter actually. Yeah. I think they existed and not a lot of people knew about them. Yeah.
But things like that I would eat every day, it's like you cannot give to kids anymore in this circle. So things like white bread and juice, which I would eat every breakfast and every
like
lunch,
every day.
is like,
you can't have juice. Kids can't have juice.
Juice is the one of the worst things you could give a child, Shale.
Oh, no way, dude. Juice. It's so good for you. Remember how good for you it is.
Yeah. Isn't that funny? And now like
it's
just I don't know. It's like has to do with glycemic load, and it's just the fastest way to get sugar into your bloodstream basically is drinking juice.
Yeah. Wow. That's crazy.
But yeah, it's just funny that the literally the everyday meals that I would have as a child, like at Cora's preschool, they would have like reported me for sending stuff like that.
Who would have reported you?
The I don't know. The teachers would have contacted child services and said,
"Oh my god." I guess they're, yeah, I don't know. Like, I remember when I was going to school, when I was growing up, like, there was, like, a fair amount of attention paid to things like the nutritional guide,
okay,
you know?
Yeah.
Like, you know, the 4 food groups, 4/5 food groups, and like having a balanced meal and that type of thing. Like that was sort of the, like, I think conventional wisdom at the time. And that type of thing still exists, I think, today, although it seems to me to be less prevalent than it was when I was in school. But maybe that's, I don't know. Do they still teach kids that in school? Do you know?
I don't think that Cora's been, like, so Cora's in kindergarten. So I don't think she's been directly like taught about it, but they still, like, it's still a big deal when the new food guides are released. Like, there was kind of a stink with I can't remember, it was last, maybe it was a couple of years ago, where, you know, the importance of dairy in the food guide is continually shrinking, which is based on science, but obviously there's a lot of pushback from the dairy industry on that. Anyway, so I think it still is.
But ice cream's safe though, right, Alan?
Sorry, what's that, Shil?
We can still have ice cream?
Well, that's another complicating factor that we haven't even touched on. Like, Cora is sensitive to dairy. She gets quite bad eczema when she has even a small amount of dairy. So that's another huge way that my diet as a child differs from hers, is that I was cheese. Like, cheese was my main source of protein, I'm sure. Like mac and cheese, pizza. But not for Cora.
Yeah, my brother, when we were younger, had like a dairy sensitivity or a dairy allergy. Mm-hmm. And we kind of shunned him because of it.
Yeah. Like, we're having pizza tonight and he has to go to the basement kind of thing?
Sort of. He had to drink different milk from us, and I think we made fun of him for it quite a bit.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, I feel bad for him now because, like, I don't know, maybe he got used to it, but to me, it never tasted very good. I tried to taste it quite a few times.
Was it soy?
Yeah, it was soy, but it didn't taste like soy milk that you get now. It was much more like, had much more of like a prominent kind of vegetal flavor.
Yeah.
And
yeah. Yeah. Soy milk's come a long way. Well, no, sorry. Dairy alternatives have come a long
way. Dairy alternatives. Yeah. And I'm sure you're aware of this, but the ice cream shop that I work at, Kind Ice Cream, has dairy-free ice cream.
Yep, so. Cora's had it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do I have anything to add to this conversation? Wait, oh, there's one more thing I wanted to touch on before you can prod me for some kind of feedback. Mm. How are things with your youngest? So how's that journey going? He's been eating for what? You said 8 months?
Yeah. So he started right around 6 months, and now he's 14 months. Yeah. Good.
And that's the same situation. You just make the food that you're normally going to make, and then you just cut it up small and put it in front of him.
Yeah, more or less. Like, he still has his favorites that we make sure we have on hand all the time, like peas and grapes and things like that. I don't think he's quite as open as Cora was, but he's good. He's a good eater.
He eats a lot.
Yeah, he likes mealtime.
What do I have to say about feeding kids?
what I had proposed when you mentioned the topic and said you wouldn't have much to contribute, I said, so like when you're cooking for a child, you have to, it's not like cooking for yourself. So you have to reduce the salt and you have to think about mm-hmm. how they will pick it up and what flavors they like. And I just asked how, if there was like any marked differences in how you would cook for someone in your family versus how you would cook for yourself, not a child, but like how you, the process of taking in to consideration, all of the preferences and, such of the people you're cooking for.
Yeah. Well, it's sort of, I don't know, I guess maybe I'm too lucky to answer this question. Most of the people in my family are pretty open, adventurous eaters. Mm. And so I don't usually have to edit too much in terms of what I want to do. Mm-hmm. Definitely when I was in like the phase of my cooking career where I was trying out all sorts of like weird flavor combinations and stuff to like try and get a sense of how, you know, like how I can be creative and cook creatively and come up with interesting ideas and stuff.
Right.
There was probably a lot of things that I tried out on them that they had to be polite about, I guess. Mm-hmm. But you know, like I think for the most part, I don't really have to edit myself too much. None of my family really has like food allergies is a big one that I know that a lot of people run into, but nobody in my family really has like any big food allergies to speak of. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So in terms of like cooking for my family, I guess like my journey over time has been, I guess, like finding the things that I know people like,
right,
you know, comfort foods and things like that. And just sort of like, you know, making those kind of like the staples of what I tend to prepare. But I'm never really like, if I want to try something, I rarely feel like I have to ask anybody for permission.
Right.
Like,
yeah,
you know, people are usually pretty excited to try something that I'm cooking for them or whatever. Mm-hmm. So I think that, you know, that says a little bit about my cooking, but a lot about, their, you know, willingness to try things and their openness to, you know, try new flavors and stuff like that. They're all, they kind of have all been forced to become foodies a little bit because, because I, you know, because they've kind of been who I've been experimenting on throughout my career. So
there's no one in your family who insists on well-done steak?
No. Everyone in my immediate family is like, you know, pretty into trying new and interesting food. And nobody has like preferences that, you know, I know, you know, that I think are like uncouth or weird or anything like that. I think, you know, like my sister-in-law, maybe like food for her isn't as exciting maybe as like, you know, it's just not maybe as like big a deal to her, you know, like in terms of like, to me, you know, food's like a big part of my life. I think to her, it's sort of like, you know, a less big part of her life, but she doesn't really have any like weird preferences that I've ever had to work around or anything like that.
Well, that's good.
And she's always very complimentary about the food that I prepare. So the only thing that I can think of where like I might run into a similar set of constraints is like coming up with a kid's menu for a restaurant or something like that.
Yeah. But just have a box of chicken fingers and fries in the freezer. Right?
It can be challenging if that's not, if you're not going to allow yourself to just like, have chicken fingers and a grilled cheese on the menu, which I have definitely done before. Yeah. Like grilled cheese is like a real good kids menu fallback, you know?
Oh, and God forbid you're one of those restaurants that makes their own ketchup. God, the kids will crucify you.
That's like, true.
I don't want cumin spiced house-made ketchup. I want Heinz.
Oh man. I love Drift's ketchup. Yep. I wonder how Avon feels about it.
Oh, I'll ask her.
I'm super curious.
She grew up with it. So that's like her Heinz kind of.
Yeah, maybe.
It's the one that has the powerful nostalgic pull.
Or do they have a bottle of Heinz in the fridge? Because when you go to a fast food restaurant, that's what you get. And she's like, I want real ketchup, Daddy.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Just kid food.
Sure.
Peas, like frozen peas.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know how to get pee when they shove the peas up their nose? Do you know how to get them out, Shale?
Let me think of how I would try to solve that problem. You get them to hold their breath and then.
Airway is obstructed. No, I'm just kidding.
You put a vacuum hose on their nose.
Let me think about that for a second. Well, no. Okay. So it probably wouldn't work because there's one pee in one nostril and then the vacuum would go over the entire nose. And so it would just draw air out of the nostril
instead of the obstructed one.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I do. Okay. Corkscrew.
Thanks for listening to Food Court, a podcast recorded in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. Food Court is hosted by Alan Sutterby and Shale McDonald. Theme music by Ryan and Shale McDonald. Make sure to subscribe to Food Court in your favorite podcast app. Check us out on the web at foodcourt.fm and follow us on Instagram at Food Court Podcast. If you want to help spread the word, please leave us a review on iTunes. We'll be back with a fresh new episode in 2 weeks. Thanks for listening.
You cover the unobstructed nostril and you blow into their mouth and they might, like if they keep their airway open, like you're just breathing into their lungs, but that's usually like pretty gross to like, so you have a natural reflex to like close your airway. And so when you breathe into the mouth, the pee will pop out of the nostril.